Virginia Lloyd's first piano was a baby grand, a toy one that she used to hoik around under her arm as a five-year-old, plonking away on its metal keys. Her hero was Schroeder, the boy genius from the Peanuts cartoon, who was always hunched over his toy piano with a bust of Beethoven on the lid. Virginia studied the instrument seriously as she grew older. Long hours of practice, performances, and competitions. But once she'd diligently passed all those piano exams, she pretty much stopped playing. Virginia found her way back to the piano after finding love and heartbreak all at once. Her new book is called Girls at the Piano. Hi, Virginia.
Hi, Sarah.
Take me back to that five-year-old you. Did you used to crouch like Schroeder did at his piano?
Well, yes, that's how you sat at a piano. Schroeder hunched over, shoulders up around his ears and holding his little hands high like paws, then that's what I did. And he was a complete inspiration to me in terms of his passion and dedication and focus. I mean, it was like he knew how to play as soon as he emerged from his mother's body. And I was completely enchanted by his skill, and I just I thought he was a terrific model to emulate.
As long as Lucy Van Pelt left him alone, well, he could really focus.
Lucy just needed to get her own hobby, really, didn't she? She just had too little to do, and she was too fixated on Schroeder when she should have been maybe learning the piano herself.
And in the TV version of those Peanuts cartoons, Schroeder used to actually play real classical music, didn't he?
Well, yes. I mean, that was one of the wonderful things that I had the opportunity to research, and I discovered that not only did Charles Schulz prefer the music of Brahms to Beethoven, but
oh, really? So
yes,
Schroeder should have been playing Brahms.
Well,
not Beethoven.
Yes, if we were faithful to his creator's preferences, we'd associate Schroeder with Brahms. But for the purposes of the cartoon, he decided that Beethoven was funnier, and to that end. The notes, if you ever see notes transcribed on the Peanuts cartoons, they're always faithful to the score.
So do you remember hearing then when you'd watch the cartoon, hearing him play Moonlight Sonata or whatever Beethoven he was tinkling away at?
Oh, yes. I mean, it was always a very short, you know, melodic fragment or something. And I guess, you know, setting the course of my preferences for music, I would hear some of the classical music, you know, scraps, and then there'd be that lovely jazz soundtrack, you know, to the Peanuts cartoons.
What about you and your toy piano? Did you manage to play real music on it?
Well, I attempted to. I had no formal knowledge.
Yeah, but see, when I had a toy instrument, I'm just banging away randomly like Animal out of the Muppets. But were you actually making songs happen on yours?
Well, according to family history, yes, I was attempting to play by ear what I heard maybe on the radio or on one of those Peanuts cartoons. So I did try. I was curious about seeing if I could do something similar to what Schroeder did, I guess.
Well, what were you hearing at home? What kind of music did your parents listen to?
Well, my dad had the bulk of the records in the family collection, and they were definitely records. And he was a big fan of country and western. And so whether I liked it or not, I was often subjected to Johnny Cash, who I regard very highly, and, you know, all manner of things. The sort of the melancholic singer-songwriters from the UK, like Ralph McTell and Gilbert O'Sullivan, that sort of, and those sorts of people. And he was also a huge fan of big bands. So he was very much into the Dorsey Brothers and Benny Goodman's orchestra and that sort of thing.
Whereabouts was your house when you were growing up?
We grew up in the lower North Shore of Sydney in a suburb called Hunters Hill.
And did your mum and dad both work?
My mother worked very hard and tirelessly, but she worked at home. My dad was always self-employed as a sort of contractor or property kind of guy, like a building He was one of those guys in the 1960s and 70s who would build small blocks of red brick units in the days before debt financing became a thing. And so he would build them, sell them, and then build the next one. So he regrets not holding on to at least one apartment in, you know, a couple of those buildings. Anyway.
Were either of them musical, Virginia? Did either of them play an instrument?
My dad was certainly more interested in music than my mum, although my mum, you know, enjoyed listening to someone like, Andy Williams, or a sort of more crooner type. And my dad, I remember when I was sort of in late primary school, maybe sixth grade, he took some clarinet lessons, I think, you know, referring back to Benny Goodman, of course. But no, he didn't know how to read music. And it was odd because he'd grown up with a mother who was a piano teacher.
When you were six or so, your dad took you to a concert. Who did you go and see with him?
It's such a vivid memory, and it's stayed with me since I was six. And we went to see the Jacques Lussier Trio at the Sydney Town Hall.
Who are they?
Now, Jacques Lussier he's still alive, is a French pianist, French jazz pianist, who came to prominence with his jazz interpretations of J.S. Bach. So depending on what you think about that, you either think it's kind of the wildest, most wonderful thing you've ever heard.
Or it is an outrage beyond all comprehension.
It's an abomination. So, you know, and I guess it's better for music to inspire, you know, passionate attachment or repulsion, I guess. You know, at least you know what you feel about it.
Well, how did you feel?
Oh, the former. I absolutely loved it. So that he was in my dad's record collection, and he didn't have any Bach in the collection, but we had Lussier playing Bach. And my dad must have seen my interest, and so he purchased these tickets, and off we went.
And at six, could you even see the stage?
Well, again, he had the foresight to buy us seats that were elevated, and he must have got in very early because they were along the side of the upper level, and he also brought binoculars. I remember this so clear. That's what an important moment it was for me. I remember it so clearly. He brought the binoculars, and I could see right down to the musicians.
And when you were looking through those binoculars, Virginia, what did you see? How were the musicians interacting with one another?
Well, it was just magical because my ears were experiencing this entire world of sound, and yet there were only three people on the stage. They're all men, and that didn't have much significance to me at the time, though it came to later. But what I really was struck by was that they were really communicating with each other, constantly using their eyes, their eyebrows, their mouths, their facial expressions, and they were listening so intently to what each was doing, and they were making something. They were making something there in the moment that had never existed before and never would again, even though it was based in the familiar structure of the Bach composition that they may have been playing at that time. And, you know, so it was ephemeral, but it was beautiful. And I just remember thinking, oh, my God, this is the most wonderful thing. And would it be possible to even learn how to do something like that? How do they know how to do that?
Well, tell me how you started learning. Who was your first teacher?
My first teacher was Mrs. Betsy Wilcox, and she lived down the rich end of Hunter's Hill along the peninsula. We were up the poor end.
The Joe Hockey end.
Yeah, really. Yeah, it was a long way from our end of Hunter's Hill. We were pretty much on the cusp of Gladesville, actually. But nevertheless, so my mother would take me down there on Wednesdays after school, and bless her, she would sit in the car and wait for me, and which is a bit scary at my first lesson because I was only seven, and I didn't realize that I wouldn't have any company. It would just be me and Mrs. Wilcox. But she was a terrific teacher, and she placed great importance on getting her students, even from their earliest lessons, into performing and becoming accustomed to playing in front of other people, which, you know, harkens back to the history of the instrument as very much a social, tool, really.
Especially for young girls.
And particularly for young girls, yes. And so Mrs. Wilcox would put on these concerts quite regularly at, in the church hall just across the road from her house. And, you know, all of the parents had to come because, you know, their little piano student was performing, and there are quite a few students to get through. Patience would be tested.
Do you remember, Virginia, the first time you actually then sat yourself at Mrs. Wilcox's piano? What did it feel like?
Well, you know, I mean, I can't say for sure, but I certainly remember what it felt like to get up on that piano stool, and my feet obviously couldn't touch the floor, so there was a little bit of climbing involved, and it was a beautiful, well cared for black upright that it was in a rather dark corner of her room, and there was a big window just beside it, and the trees would sway and the shadows would dance across the side of the instrument, and I was very struck by the fact that I could actually see myself in the polished sort of the front piece. I don't know the name for it. I could see myself, and it was quite thrilling and a little bit unnerving at the same time. But it was such a thrill to get up at that piano and just, I was always full of excitement and anticipation at what I might learn that day.
And your parents, you know, saw your excitement and your talent. What happened for you to get your own piano? Did you get to choose it yourself?
Well, Mrs. Wilcox had to suggest to my parents after about a month of lessons that I really would improve more quickly if I had a piano of my own to play on. In that interim period, I'd been going up the street to play on a neighbour's piano, and I was just so embarrassed because there was a boy there who was in the class above me, the year above me at Hunters Hill Primary School, and I didn't, you know, I really wanted to be able to practice in by myself, and his mother was very generous, laying out sort of cookies and, you know, milk and stuff. It was just, I just wanted to be left alone with the piano, really. And so I was very fortunate that my parents, I don't know how they did it, but they were able to probably, you know, forego other purchases, as parents do, and buy a modest but lovely chestnut coloured
Were you allowed to choose the piano, or
yes? Well, I do, you know, there's an apocryphal story in our family going with my dad to choose a piano, and it was like being in a paddock, but instead of cows or sheep, there were pianos, you know, different colours and sizes. It's quite funny, really. And of course, I had to sort of get up on these new pianos and play something. You know, the salesperson is thinking, this is looking pretty tasty. I think I'm guaranteed of a sale here. And precocious girl and a loving father. And so the apocryphal story goes that I was playing something, made some error, and I stopped and I said, oops, I made a mistake. And then I corrected myself and played whatever it was properly. And the salesperson turned to my father and said, the important thing is she knew she'd made a mistake. She knows what she's doing. And of course, my dad interpreted that as an indication of my, you know, extreme talent. And there was
we'll
a piano.
It. We'll take it.
We'll take it. Okay, sold. Sold to the dad in the corner.
And did you love having one at home?
Oh, my. Oh, yes. It was really, you know, a piano of one's own. What an extravagant luxury that was. And nobody else wanted to be sitting at it. I didn't have to fight with siblings. My younger brother had no interest. He became interested temporarily in the guitar after he heard Jimi Hendrix, but that wasn't for some years. But I really, it was one thing in the house that I really had to myself, and it became this strange place of privacy in public, you know, which is what I've spent some time thinking about.
Yes, there's something powerful about having your back to the rest of the room, but that sound that you're making filling the space. On Conversations, my guest is Virginia Lloyd, who started playing the piano as a young child and has written a book about her story, but also the wider history of pianos. It's called Girls at the Piano. Tell me about sight reading, Virginia, and how good were you at that?
I loved sight reading. I think I'm just someone who enjoys crazy challenges, and maybe
so
I just had a...
Talk me through, as someone who doesn't play, what happens when you're sight reading?
I'm not saying I'd be as adept today as I used to be, but sight reading is the process of being able to, if you were to give me a random piece of music, of printed music, I would prop it on the piano and I would more or less be able to play it so that you could recognize it if you knew what the piece was. So it involves being able to read in the same way that words on a page are a series, really, if you think about it, a series of black dots and squiggles on white, generally white paper. Music manuscript is the same in terms of you've got your stave of five lines and in the treble and five lines in the bass, which is more or less equivalent to right and left hand, broadly speaking. And you have your notes, and it talks about the duration, you learn to understand the duration of a particular note, and if you are comfortable and adept technically at moving around your hands moving around the piano, you need to be quite still in the middle. Sight reading involves being able to look far enough ahead in the work, whether it's just kind of a couple of bars, so that you can anticipate what's happening, put your hands where they need to be in time to play the notes at the moment that the composer has instructed that you play them. So a sight reading is never perfect. Well, certainly not in my experience. But maybe that tells you how, I was pretty good, but I'm sure there are lots of people who are better. I was so... sight reading also relies on having a lot of practice at sight reading. It's something that really can be improved if you have access to a lot of new music. And because as I grew older, I was doing a lot of accompanying, people would give me new music all the time. And I suppose because I was good at the sight reading, more people would then ask me to accompany them. And I became a kind of a go-to accompanist in my local neighbourhood and then obviously at school and beyond.
And it almost sounds like it became quite addictive, or quite the challenge of being able to sight read new music was a bit of a hunger almost.
Yes. And weirdly, I don't think it happens anymore, but in the competitions known as Estedfords, at the time I was... good at sight reading, there were even sight reading competitions.
They love those competitions. Competition on anything. Best way to sit on the stool, most polished piano, competition on sight reading. What about perfect pitch, which is something you also have? When did you realise that? Or who did someone else have to point that out to you?
Someone else had to point it out to me. So perfect pitch is a freak of memory. I found online a few years ago like an online self-test for perfect pitch, and at that time, maybe it was 4 or 5 years ago, I tested myself and it was still, I was just sort of hanging in there, I still had it just enough.
And what does it mean?
Now it's gone off, I have to say, it's gone off. What it means is that if I heard a note, if you played a note on the piano or on the flute or the violin, I would be able to tell you what that note was without reference to a piece of music. So, for example, when I was at high school and I sang in the Madrigals group, which was unaccompanied, they didn't need a piano because I could just sound the note A from which the singers then could take their starting note. So... does that make sense?
Yes, yeah. So that, though, I mean, if your ear can do that, it must be able to do that with every sound, not just with music. Like, are you always hearing, I mean, can you hear any sound in terms of the pitch that it's making, or is it limited to musical sounds?
I think it's something that is not only a freak of oral memory, being able to associate, like, because it's a particular frequency, that's what a musical note is. But it's also very culturally determined, if you think about it. Like, if I listen to music from Persia or West Africa, for example, I'd be at a loss to be able to specify the particular series of notes that someone was singing or playing in. But if it's particularly piano music or Western orchestral music, I have a much easier time of identifying, oh, that sounds like it's in D major or G minor or B flat.
So this ability to sight read, the ability to have perfect pitch, obviously make you a delight as a student for a teacher. How long did you stay with Mrs. Wilcox, Betty Wilcox, for?
Well, I stayed until she forced me out, really. I was devastated. She had decided, I went to her when I had just turned 7, and I was with her probably 5 or 6 years, maybe 6 years, and she felt that she had reached the limit of what she could teach me, and she encouraged me to go to another teacher who could develop me further as a pianist.
And was that a very different kind of experience of being taught? Was it a different sort of teacher?
My next teacher, Mr. McFarlane, I'll call him, was very... I enjoyed my lessons, but when I say enjoy, I enjoyed mostly the intense learning of it. I did feel slightly uncomfortable in those lessons, simply because I always felt I wasn't quite as good as he thought I was, which was much more to do with my own sort of negative self-talk, which had started creeping in, unfortunately. And I was about 12 or 13 at that time. But he was an excellent teacher and really was able to get me to a technical level that, I really didn't think I could myself.
And he, following on, had the expectation that you would be in competitions, you'd be passing exams. What's the atmosphere like as you're 12 or 13 going into a room of other young pianists at a competition?
Well, it's a bit daunting. Yes, he was very, in the same way that Mrs. Wilcox was big on performance, Mr. McFarlane was big on competitions, and he would encourage me to be in competitions among people who were slightly older than I was, and which is really terrific to stretch me in that way. And you turn up at these sort of nondescript venues scattered around Sydney, and you have a number, and you have a plastic chair to sit on, and you have someone with you, a parent usually, and as I got older, I would just go to them by myself. And you just wait until your turn comes. And usually by the time my turn came, I'd already heard somebody who was, so much better than I was at that particular piece, and also somebody that, who was really struggling. So I always felt that I was sort of somewhere in the middle.
Were you successful at them in terms of the winning of a Steadfords? Was that part of what kept you going?
You know what? I must have enjoyed the competition. I didn't win very much, but I often came runner-up. So I would say that would be a fair reflection of my skill level, that I was very good, but there was a whole other realm that was not mine to reach for various reasons.
And at this point, you're also, you're at high school. How did playing the piano affect your social standing among other girls at school, Virginia?
Well, any woman who's been through year 9 at high school can attest that anything that makes you stand out is a bit of a mixed blessing. So as we were talking earlier about how when you're sitting at the piano, you have your back to the world, and yet you're the one producing the sounds. And in the same way, that was a double-edged sword at my high school, because I was the piano player because of the sight reading, because I was you know, technically quite advanced for my age. I was the go-to accompanist for the high school twice a week at assembly, and there were, you know, 300 or 400 students there, and they saw my ponytail and the back of me as I played the hymns and the school song and the what have you.
And when you were with your friends or other girls, not at the assembly stage, what sort of tunes did you belt out on the piano for them? What got those grade 9 girls on side?
Well, we're talking about the era of Tom Berlinson and The Man from Snowy River. So I often received requests for Jessica's Theme, you know, when my music teacher was late to class, you know, I'd be playing Billy Joel or Elton John. It was a time that was generous to piano players.
How did your persona at the piano compare to Virginia not at the piano?
I was much more expansive at the piano, and I was improvising and making stuff up and very expressive, particularly when accompanying, compared to away from the piano, where increasingly I would struggle to say boo to anyone.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio.
What were all those exams and competitions meant to culminate in? What was the final point of all this study?
That's a very good question, Sarah.
Did you ask yourself that, or were you just swept up in
that? Well, you know what's funny? It's a question that I've only asked myself in recent years, but at the time I was such a goal-oriented teenager and, you know, adolescent, that I really just kind of measured out my life in, you know, goals, you know, and it was either a school-based assessment of some kind, or it was, you know, a piano competition or a piano exam, you know, late in every year. And, you know, as far as I was concerned, I just kept jumping the hoops like a prize show pony. And
so did you dream of becoming a musician like those musicians you saw on the stage with your dad at City Hall?
Well, again, I didn't really allow myself the luxury of thinking about that. I really didn't consider myself as good as everybody else considered me to be. And that was a real problem, because I also got myself into a bit of a straitjacket about what sort of careers might be possible in music for someone who maybe wasn't going to go on to be a member of an orchestra or, you know, a solo concert artist, because I knew I was neither good enough to do that, to pursue that, nor was I that in love with the sort of repertoire that I would need to immerse myself in.
Well, that's it. So you were practicing and being being judged on the classical repertoire, but what were you listening to when it came to your own pleasure?
Ah, yes. Well, my thrilling discovery, and again referring back to that Jacques Lussier concert when I was 6 years old, was that I discovered jazz and improvisation. And again, sort of digging through a couple of different records of my father's, but really starting to turn my ears, you know, further afield, and I found some radio stations that would play music that just, my ears just perked up, you know, like a dog's ears when they hear something interesting. I just started listening to music that, you know, whether it was even just something as simple as Miles Davis or John Coltrane, or some of the singers, Betty Carter and Sarah Vaughan and so forth, and the Australian singer-songwriter Vince Jones. It was an incredibly, incredibly significant discovery for me as a, you know, jazz loving a teenage girl. And he wrote, you know, plenty of original material, which really spoke very loudly to me. But he also chose very carefully and made really interesting choices of other people's material to cover in his own distinctive way.
So did you ever try playing some of that music at any of your competitions or for any exams? Was there any possibility for you to bring jazz into that world?
One time I mustered up the courage to ask Mr. McFarlane if I could perform in the jazz instrumental solo Estedford competition, and he was rather taken aback, but to his credit, asked me what I'd like to perform, and I had a book, you know, I'd furtively started a collection of contemporary jazz, you know, printed music and other sort of pop and rock soft, you know, classic books in paperback, and I was playing them at home. But I had this Brubeck book, and I really loved Blue Rondo a la Turk. And he, you know, to my surprise, he knew all about the album, the famous Take Five Time Out album, which is known mostly for Take Five. And so, you know, we sat down together in excruciating silence, listened to Brubeck's band play Blue Rondo a la Turk, and then I trotted off to the it was at the Opera House, I think, this particular competition, and I was quite flummoxed when I thought I'd done quite well, and I was certainly being faithful to Brubeck's rendition, which I felt was pretty reliable. And then I had the adjudicator tell me that I'd got it all wrong. So I was quite outraged, actually.
And it was back at the Opera House that you went for a concert playing or a competition playing Chopin at the culmination of your classical repertoire studies. Tell me about that concert. Well, actually, first tell me about the piece that you were playing, about that piece by Chopin.
Well, the piece for this particular competition was Chopin's Revolutionary Etude, and it goes by very quickly, and it's extremely demanding.
What is it about it that's so tricky technically?
It begins with a very fast run of notes from way up high on the keyboard, you know, way down, very, very quickly, down to the sort of the middle of the piano, and then you know, you have to splay your fingers open to do a run of consecutive octaves, which is playing the same note 8 notes apart. So the lower one on your thumb and the upper one on your little finger, and, you know, going up the keyboard.
Just watching what you're doing with your hand now as you're miming doing this, my hand is hurting. I mean, that is a huge demand just physically.
Right. And so in my case, what happened, I was practicing probably incorrectly, as it turns out, but I was practicing very intensively. And I'd started, you know, a few months prior to the competition, I'd started to experience some tightness in my forearm when I was doing those consecutive octaves. And by the time the competition came around, it was kicking in pretty early. And I thought, my aim is to just get through this piece cleanly from beginning to end. And I had a major, you know, really my final piano exam was coming up probably a couple of months after that competition. And I thought, I'll get through this, do my exam, and then I think I've had enough. And what happened at that competition was that I was really the only non-conservatorium high school student there. By that stage, all the other sort of amateur players had found other things to do, and they weren't doing competitions. They were all, the people who were there were very serious about pursuing their music careers. And there was me on my own. I had eschewed offers of support, which I then regretted. There were renditions of this piece that were just mind-bogglingly impressive. And I thought, wow, I'm just so not
sinking
up to this.
Sinking lower and lower into your seat.
Finally got on stage, and all I could feel was the spotlight and these incredible competitors watching me, and my hand just seized up almost from the get-go. And there was this almighty, you know, I was about a page and a half in my, you know, I was playing it from memory, of course, which is, you know, part of the performance of piano playing, particularly in competition and, you know, performance. And I was about a page and a half in my mind's eye of 7 pages, I think, and my right hand and forearm just seized up, and I was like a car crash. It just crashed all the way along the keyboard, and people were so astonished. It was just humiliating. I did manage to sort of limp musically to the end of the piece. There wasn't, because it was over very quickly, but there were a few claps, but it was very sad, and I was just burning with shame and got off that stage as quick as I could.
How did you see yourself after that performance?
Well, it just confirmed my suspicions that it really wasn't the thing for me to be doing.
Was there any relief in that shame?
There was a relief, because there it just drew a line underneath all of my studies and all of my solo performing, which I had grown increasingly anxious about, and so I could no longer sort of kid myself that this was something I enjoyed.
It was like you had to keep pushing yourself until you finally came to that cliff, and then you were allowed to step away.
Yeah, that's it. And so there was great clarity there for the first time.
So after you still diligently finished that, finished your grading, passed your final exam, what happened with you and the piano then? Did you finish playing completely?
I stopped playing for some time, but I was by that stage just starting in my undergraduate studies at the University of Sydney, and I realised that the piano was quite a useful way to generate an income as a student. So even though I didn't give myself credit for making a career out of it, I did use the piano for, I had some great part-time jobs. I was a ballet school accompanist. Can we have some skipping music now, please, Miss Virginia? And I was, I taught piano to local children, and those, you know, they were great ways to earn some money.
Tell me about your husband, John, Virginia. Where did you meet him?
I met John through mutual friends in Sydney, and little did I know, but he had cancer, and unfortunately, I fell in love with him because he was such a special person, and we married about a year after we met.
Tell me about your wedding. Was there music there?
There was. We had a jazz quartet. Strangely enough, maybe it was a trio. No, I think it was a quartet.
You didn't play, but you were
I didn't dancing. Play. I hired those musicians. They were students at the aforementioned conservatorium, doing the jazz studies course. And we had a great time. It was and John was originally from London, of Irish stock, and he had several old friends come and join him for the day, because they were so thrilled for him and for us.
How sick was he at your wedding? I mean, what was his prognosis at that point in your relationship?
Well, the prognosis was sufficiently bad that we'd already had our honeymoon. So, and because they told us that his mobility, he had secondary cancer in his pelvic and thigh bones. And so actually a couple of weeks out from the wedding, he lost the ability to walk. So in the wedding photographs, he's on crutches. And as I wrote about in my first book, I was so avoiding the reality of what was to come, that my first thought when he told me he'd have to use crutches, was like, well, that's not going to look very nice in the wedding photos. Right, got the priorities right there.
It was a stress reaction, Virginia.
Yes, I hope so.
Did you play for John during your time together, during your relationship?
I did, and he loved it. He loved it.
So you had that piano from your mum and dad's house
The same piano, and he loved me playing for him. And I didn't play nearly enough, because I had spent such a long time not playing. By then I was, you know, in my early 30s, and I really just, again, just had such a negative perception of my playing, and I couldn't really just enjoy it. I felt very limited by my, you know, what I was, my dexterity. I just compared it to how it used to be, and which was not very useful at all. And so after John died, I was seized with regret that I hadn't played more for him, because he really did enjoy it. And in fact, I played Strangers in the Night for him.
Tell us about that, the final whereabouts you and John were, where you had what was to be really your final kind of meaningful conversation.
We're in the palliative care unit at Canterbury Hospital in southwestern Sydney, and he was so ravaged by the disease, and he really had a matter of days or hours left. We really didn't know which at that point, but it wasn't long. And we had a little kind of patient's room to ourselves, and they wheeled him in because he was connected to all manner of support equipment. And he was able to, there was this dinky little Casio keyboard. Honestly, it was about as long as my elbow. And I found it and in the patient's room, and he could just manage in a whisper to suggest Strangers in the Night. I don't know why. It wasn't a song that meant anything to us prior to that, but that's what popped into his head. And so I cobbled together a little Casio keyboard version of that, and it was a pretty special moment, you know, fairly, yeah, I won't forget that.
It strikes me too, listening to you, that the thing about the music exams and the competitions and the repertoire is it's so structured, and there's that kind of security or clarity around what you have to do. And then you're thrown into something like that with John that there's no script for, there's no notation you can follow. It's this sort of profound improvisation in how to be in this experience.
Well, that's the word, you know, improvisation. And honestly, I've concluded that that's what we're all doing in our lives.
Well, tell me about improvisation, because is it just a case of, you know, you can play whatever you want, however you want? How does improvisation work?
Well, that's the classic joke about jazz music. If the people who are not particularly interested, say, oh, don't you just sort of make it up as you go along? And that's not the case. I'm here to tell you. I would like to clarify that point. What it is that a jazz tune, or any tune that a jazz musician might play, has a structure to it, and it has a melody. Usually it has, well, mostly it has a melody.
Aspiration is melody.
Yeah, it's certainly easier on the listener, on the general listener, if there's a melody, but you know, fans of Ornette Coleman might choose to disagree with me there. And underneath that melody is a moving harmony, you know, and the structure of the piece could be you have the, you know, original melody, and it's similar to a pop tune in which you have a melody, you have the two choruses, then it goes into a bridge section, which, you know, slightly different keys, different sort of notes, and then you come back to the main melody. So there's a familiar terrain, if you like. And what the jazz musician does during an improvisation is come up with ideas based on either the melody or the chords that are underpinning that melody that make up the structure of the piece.
So you're working within that form.
You're working within that framework. You might be inspired by something the drummer just did, you know, as a little flourish, and you might translate that into doing a similar thing, you know, with your fingers. You know, I'm talking about a piano player. But usually it's some variation on the melody, and you'll find if you listen to a jazz improvisation that at certain points the musician will make a musical reference back to the melody or do something at the point at which the bridge section goes back to the main melody, so that you're giving the other musicians as well as the listener kind of a roadmap or a signal that we're going back to the main road now, or we're going to go on the exit. Or does that make sense?
As well as it can to someone who struggles with all of these things. But Virginia, for you, after John died, and after you completed renovating the house that you lived in together, you moved to New York. Is this where you started playing, or how did you come to start playing with a jazz group there? Where were you? Where did you used to go?
Well, this... It really wasn't until I met my current partner, Nate, that I returned to playing. And
was it his suggestion, or how are they related, those two things?
I think so. And I was widowed for about 5.5 years, and I was pretty tired of that. and I was very lonely, you know, and instead of returning to the piano, I avoided it. I think it made me too sad, actually, and because it reminded me of John, it reminded me of the road not taken, all of those things. And you know, like most changes in life, if you can change your perception of something, then other opportunities can open up. And I think that's what happened when I met Nate. We were two peas in a pod, and he's a jazz fan, bless him, and we just, you know, I really started enjoying my life again, and he bought me a keyboard, bigger than that little Casio I was referring to earlier. He bought me a quite a lovely keyboard, and so that was in our apartment in Brooklyn. And then I looked into playing with an ensemble, and I found this terrific amateur jazz workshops. And I would, I just loved them.
Well, even that, it's so different from being alone under the spotlight on a stage, as you were as a young person playing the piano. What's the joy in playing with other people?
Well, I mean, I'd forgotten how much fun it is to play with other people, because it's not all on you. You know, you're creating something together. You're communicating with the other musicians, you're listening to each other, you're excited by an idea that someone might have just caught and expressed in that moment on whatever instrument they might play. There's a beginning and a middle and an end, and you know, if one of you runs off the rails, then the others will, you know, kind of carry you to the end of the line. So it very much is a collaborative, creative effort, and I really love that.
And there's a pleasure in being the amateur, not the perfect player.
Absolutely. No shame in being a passionate amateur, as I have learned.
Virginia, you've got a daughter now. Had you always hoped to have kids?
I had planned never to have children. I was quite adamant about that. And no one was more surprised than me when, at the age of 44, got that little crosshair on the pregnancy kit. Really wasn't expecting that. And the only people more surprised than me were my parents. And now my daughter Hazel is 3 years old, and I couldn't be happier.
Do you want her to learn the piano?
I want to expose her to a whole range of different instruments so that she can decide whether she's into one rather than another. I think my own thinking was, I was very constrained in my thinking. It didn't occur to me that I could pursue a different instrument. We have a collection of a few different. We've got a piano accordion at home, a thumb piano, a ukulele, a flute, you know.
And if she does lean towards an instrument and want to take it up, if she shares some of your musical gifts, how will you want her to be taught? Is there a way that you will want her to learn differently than the way you learnt?
I would prefer it, assuming that I can influence her, I would prefer it if she learned about, you know, chords and harmonies and, you know, really arranging music, actually, and not so strictly repertoire-based in terms of the classical music repertoire. I mean, certainly you need, I would love her to have a technical grounding in so that she would have the dexterity, but I would love her ears to be open enough and that she would trust her own musical intuition to follow the repertoire that she really loves.
Virginia, it has been a pleasure to talk to you and an education in music theory and even jazz, which I didn't expect to get today. Thank you so much for coming on Conversations.
Thank you, Sarah.
Virginia's new book is called Girls at the Piano, and her earlier memoir is The Young Widow's Book of Home Improvement. abc.net.au/conversations is our website, and you can get all the details there. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.